Hi, everybody. Just a quick holiday season reminder. My book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, How Food Lovers, Free Spirits, Misfits, and Wanderers Created a New American Profession, is available everywhere books are sold and makes a great gift for the food or chef-obsessed person in your life, or a great use of that Amazon gift card somebody might have given you or be about to give you. It's the book The Wall Street Journal calls Fast, Furious, and Fun, that Salon.com calls a terrific history of chefs in America, and about which legendary food writer Ruth Reichel wrote, "It's impressive, I haven't read anything like it." That's Chef's Drugs and Rock and Roll. Happy holidays and happy reading.
This program is brought to you by Juul, sous vide by Chef Steps. Juul takes the guesswork out of cooking. Learn more at chefsteps.com/joule.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
Give me revenue. Give me people coming to the restaurant. Like, I want to go to work every day. I want to go to the market every day. I want to buy produce. I want to see guests. I want to run my business. And, you know, I think, sure, that's a byproduct of maturity. But what is maturity besides, like, falling down as many times as you have throughout your life and recognizing that, hey, you know what? Like, you might be hot shit today, but tomorrow you're going to suck. Tomorrow you're going to have a terrible day. Tomorrow, like life will come back around and kick you right in the teeth again. Mm-hmm. And if you don't, like, kind of get, like, a nice home base and, like, a little bit more settled and just do your work, you know, people are actually going to cheer for it at some point.
I mean, it does feel wonderful. I don't think it's something that's on our mind. I mean, maybe I'm speaking for myself, but when we're at the restaurant, we're not thinking about, wow, we're really hot, we're really awesome, like, you know, living in that moment, we're doing our best to make sure that we're consistent and things are amazing and we're very focused on just doing what we do.
It doesn't change the work.
It doesn't change the work at all.
Those are chefs David Neufeld and Angela Pinkerton of Kefiko Restaurant in San Francisco, California. Our guests today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, here with
Caitlin Friedman.
Caitlin, I just drafted you.
I know. My morning went in a totally different direction.
You were hanging out. You were watching, I don't even know what, something Saturday morning movie.
On Netflix.
And chilling out. Yep. And I had a moment because I had recorded the show, edited the show, was about to transmit it, and I had two pieces of news hit me. One I'm very sad about and one I'm very happy about.
Wow.
I'm going to do the one I'm happy about first.
Okay.
So what is the coolest thing a podcast can do?
Go live?
I believe the coolest thing a podcast can do is a show with a live audience.
So I was right.
Yes. Well, you knew the answer. I mean, this is dishonest. I try to be honest. I always tell my listeners, well, I will never lie to them.
It could have gone another way. You could have just said, interview someone amazing.
That's going to also be true.
Okay.
Okay, so here's what's happening. I am so excited to announce this, and you guys are the first to hear about it. I am going to be participating, or I should say Andrew Talks to Chefs is going to be participating in the second annual Brooklyn Podcast Festival. That is a live festival. It takes place at three different venues in Brooklyn, New York. It's happening in January. I'm going to be doing a live show at the Bell House. And if you live or if you've ever been in the Gowanus area and if you've been to the Bell House, you know that's a very cool place to do anything. And we're going to do a live show, Caitlin. It's a 350-seat venue. It's then going to air eventually on the podcast. But we're going to do a live show with a live audience. The headliner guest is going to be Tom Colicchio.
I know. When you told me that, I was so excited for you.
I'm really happy. I've never interviewed Tom on The Front Burner, my old show with Jimmy Bradley. I've never had him on this show. I have interviewed him for the book. He, I think, is like one of the great interviews you can have covering the chef world because he has roots that go back into the 80s. He worked at places like the Gotham Bar and Grill and the Quilted Giraffe and, you know, was part of that amazing generation. Then he came into his own as a chef. I think he's just incredible. He was at the Gramercy Tavern and then Open Craft, which is a fantastic restaurant. And he's opened several crafts and craft offshoots around the country and other restaurants that stand on their own that have nothing to do with craft. And he obviously has now been a part of the television world. He's been the head judge of Top Chef for what is about to be the 16th season.
What?
So Tom's like straddles all these different eras and areas, and he's also super intelligent, and you know, he's very out there and very open about his view of world events and politics. And I can't think of a better guest. I'm so excited to have him. We are also going to have, and this is what I just found out because I did not know the third member of this panel until I had edited the original version of this intro. But now I can say with full confidence what the panel will be. We are also, in addition to my deep dive interview with Tom, we are going to do a panel discussion, Brooklyn Then and Now. So we are going to have Alan Harding, who is one of the pioneers of the modern Brooklyn restaurant scene. Alan used to have a place called Patois. That was his first one. He was a Manhattan chef that went over the bridge into Brooklyn and got a lot of attention. He's had a bunch of places over the years. Most recently, he was affiliated with the Gowanus Yacht Club, which is this funky little seasonal bar that happens in the spring and summer. Alex Raj, who got known at Tia Paul and El Quinto Pino and Tiklico in Manhattan, then opened La Vara several years ago in Brooklyn, and just recently opened St. Julivert, which is a seafood restaurant. She is going to be on the panel. And one of the hottest young chefs in the country, Greg Backstrom of Olmsted Restaurant, who was a first-season guest on this show, is going to be on the panel as well. Those will be the three panelists. So it will be the headliner interview with Tom Colicchio, Brooklyn Then and Now with those three chefs. You're going to come on stage. You didn't know that before you came on air.
What are you talking about?
You're going to come on stage. We're going to create the show on stage.
Okay.
And there's a band called Fathers, which is comprised of some of the members of After School Special, which is the band that does the theme music for this show. They are going to be live at the venue doing the theme song and all the break music and all that. And additionally, between doors open and showtime, they will be performing their own music. There'll be a live set.
So is the set before or after?
Oh my gosh, Caitlin.
What?
Between doors open and showtime. I'm not editing that out.
Just edit it
out. No, that stays in.
Just keep going. Sorry, I don't know where I went. I'm back.
Okay.
Wait, Andrew, when is it?
Oh, right. The show is Saturday, January 12th. Doors open at 2 p.m. Show begins at 2:30, and it'll run for about 90 minutes. It's going to be a great time. Anyway, guys, this is all going to be on my social media. The handle for this show is at Chef Podcast, so you can get this there. But I will tell you, if you want to get tickets, if you want to be among the first to get tickets, the address for tickets for this show specifically is ATTC. That is Andrew Talks to Chefs. ATTC BKPodfest.eventbrite.com. If you didn't get a chance to write that down, don't worry. It will be on my social media over the next several weeks. You'll be able to find it. You can also just Google up Brooklyn Podcast Festival, find your way to it there. And I want to tell you, it's a $15 ticket, but with the promo code Andrew, just $10. $10 for Tom Colicchio, Greg Backstrom, Alex Raj, Alan Harding, live music, Caitlin, and me. It's about a 90-minute show, 2 hours if you count the band set. What?
I'm just laughing because I had no idea I was doing this.
Yes, you're going to come on and be on there with me. Okay. Do I need to say anything else about that?
No.
All right. Please, if you're in the New York area, if you have friends in the New York area, let them know. I think it's going to be a really great show. Also, I have to say, I cannot believe this, but you know who's on right after me?
Who?
Pop Culture Happy Hour.
I love that show.
Yeah, that is one of the NPR shows that I listened to when I was sort of in training, when I decided I wanted to do a podcast. They were one of the like four or five shows that I listened to. They're like one of my role models.
You need to reach out to them.
No. I don't know if they need that kind of, I don't know. I feel like they'd be a little stalkery, but.
Okay, fine.
But they're right after
me. But you can stalk them in real life.
Yes,
I can stalk them
in real life. Okay. So today's guests are David Neufeld and Angela Pinkerton. They have one of the hottest restaurants in the country. They have Kefiko. That is spelled, you're rolling, you don't know what that means.
Well, I wasn't rolling my eyes. I was going, how do you spell
that? What does
that
mean?
Yeah, no, how do you spell it?
Yeah, so it's C-H-E, mm-hmm. and the second word is F-I-C-O. It is an Italian phrase. We explain it in the interview. But the key thing is that you are supposed to actually say it with some emphasis, or as David says in the interview, some gusto. So every time I say it, I just like to go a little, Kefiko.
Okay.
That's the name of it. Anyway, it made earlier this year the Bon Appetit Hot 10 list of hot restaurants in the country. And then, since we recorded this interview, it made Esquire Magazine's list of best restaurants in the country. And I should say the Esquire list is prepared by our semi-neighbor, two villages over, Jeff Gordner.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, but we don't talk about it in the interview because this interview was recorded before that ran. So David and Angela are the chef and pastry chef of Kefiko. The sad piece of news, I alluded to two pieces of news at the beginning of this intro and why I'm redoing this intro very suddenly because I found both of these things out in the interim. They had they have for another week what was billed as a dinette and bakery called Theorita. It was relatively recently open when we had done this interview, and they're closing.
Aww.
They're closing. So I'm very sad. We do talk about it in the interview. I'm going to leave it in. We don't talk about it that much.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have to say it's very poignant to me. It's actually the last thing we talk about in the episode. And I think, you know, from a scientific, detached, impersonal way of looking at it, this episode sort of illustrates what young chefs and restaurateurs are up against right now, right? They have one restaurant that's red hot.
Mm-hmm.
They have another restaurant that just couldn't hang in, and they've made the decision to close it. If what I've read is accurate online, they're going to be doing something else in that space, so I'll look forward to that. I should say I haven't been to even Kefiko. I haven't even been there. But my condolences, guys. There was so much excitement in your voices when you talked about it. I'm very sorry to hear about it. This news is not super fresh. It's about a week old. I hadn't heard it here in New York. I've been running around like a madman. But while I was getting, you know, the notes together for the show description and the social media tags and all that, I noticed that there had been this announcement. So I'm very sad about that. But on the happier side of things, they still have one of the hottest restaurants in the United States and one of the places I cannot wait to visit the next time I'm in the Bay Area. It may even be at the very tippy top of my list.
Really?
Maybe we'll go together.
Oh, that sounds great.
Maybe we'll do a live show in San Francisco.
Can we go tomorrow?
Yeah. I mean, we might get put up on child endangerment charges if we leave our kids.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, that. Okay. This interview was conducted several weeks ago at the Mermaid Inn restaurant in New York City. My friend Danny Abrams owns the Three Mermaid Inns, and he has graciously invited me to make them my home for the podcast when I'm out and about, if I need a location. They're only open for dinner there, so if I can come in during the day, they let me use the space.
I didn't know that. That's really nice
of
them.
Yeah. So J.J. Johnson, I used the Upper West Side space a couple of months back, and this was at their Second Avenue space in the East Village a few weeks back. Also, I need to say to David and Angela, if it seems like it took a while for me to get this show up, you guys, you know, a couple episodes back, I alluded to the fact that I look at these episodes and the way I sequence them, the way a DJ looks at, you know, a mix or the sequencing of songs. There were a couple of people who have books out. I wanted to give them as much time during the holidays as I could because that's obviously when people who have books are looking to sell them. And I felt like this interview was very much an evergreen one. It turns out that was mostly true, but then there's this poignant news about Fiorito, which I feel terrible about, but I am at least glad I got to acknowledge it on the air. So does that all sound okay, Caitlin?
I think that sounds pretty good.
Okay. I also need to thank Susan Hosmer for setting up this interview. I also need to thank Stephanie Davis for setting up this interview and Susan Hosmer, who was kind of shepherding David and Angela around town, who helped make it happen that day and also was nice enough to run out and get us coffees. You'll hear that happen during the show. Okay, with that, I'm going to ask you all to imagine that you are walking into the Mermaid Inn on a weekday afternoon, that you go through the main dining room where the staff is setting up and the cooks are prepping in the open kitchen. You go through to the back patio, which is tented for the season, and you find me, Angela, and David at a table beginning our conversation. Here you go. Your restaurant in San Francisco is, how do we say it? How do you say it? It's hot. Angela just burst into laughter. You guys are red hot.
When you said, how do you say it? I was used to people just saying, how do you say the name?
No. Yeah, oh, well, yeah, that. Like, well, why don't we get that out of the way? Why don't we get that out of the way? Nobody.
Are you gonna do your lesson?
Wait. So first we got to say how it's spelled. It is spelled C-H-E, and the second word is F-I-C-O.
Yeah.
Before we give the pronunciation, it translates to what?
So the literal translation means what a fig, which doesn't make a ton of sense, but
right.
It's a slang term in Italy used to basically say, oh, that's cool. So
right.
You'll hear that. And then later on, we also found out it's a it's kind of a catcall also for women to call men.
For women to call men.
Yeah.
Oh, so, wow.
And in classic Italian form. We didn't know that.
Wow. That's so of the moment.
Yeah, basically saying,
part of the reckoning.
Like, you know, calling a man a juicy piece of fruit almost.
Okay.
Which we definitely found that out later.
Is there a context in Italy where that was, is there like, you know, in the U.S. or at least in New York, right, the stereotypical moment is the construction workers on a lunch break.
Yeah.
On Central Park South. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what comes to my mind.
Well, totally, and I mean, that's...
But where would that happen in Italy?
Well, I mean, you know, in Rome, you still kind of, you'll walk through neighborhoods and you'll see women turn around and definitely call across the street to a man. I mean,
yeah.
It's just a fact of life there. In Naples, you'll see that kind of stuff all the time, to be honest.
Okay. This has never happened to me. Should I be offended?
No, not at all. Not at all. Just spend more time there, I'm sure.
It's just eventually.
You know, you got to tick away
eventually
at it,
some
know,
kindly grandmother will take pity on me.
Listen, you know, it takes all kinds.
Okay, so it's spelled C-H-E, and the second word is F-I-C-O. Most people who see that, as I did before I did some research on you guys, would say Che Fico.
Right.
That is wrong.
Correct.
Go ahead. How do you say it properly?
So you said Che Fico.
Che Fico.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've heard every iteration of it. Che Fico. Che Fico. Che Fico. Angela one time got corrected at a charity event we were doing. By a woman saying that she didn't say the name of our restaurant correctly, and Angela...
She told me I should learn how to pronounce it before we open.
Yeah.
Pronounce the name of my own restaurant.
Which was really funny, and then Angela said, I should have slapped the ice cream out of her hand.
Nice!
Because we were definitely running low on ice cream for that event, and she's like, I should have just taken hers back. I didn't want to give her...
That's for you. No ice cream for you.
Okay, so as I was saying... but you guys are in this moment. This is this coveted moment. There's more restaurants in this country than there ever have been before. There's more, you know, every season you can look at, you know, Eater or whatever blog in a given town and see, you know, the number of notable new openings. It's usually it's always in the double figure. Sometimes it's in the 30s. I mean, it's crazy. There's so much competition. There's so much competition for attention. And Bon Appetit you're on their list of 10 restaurants this year. That are kind of in the stratosphere of, you know, what we would call like worthiness, heat, attention, interest. What's this moment like? Before we get into your guys' backstory, what's it like to be at a restaurant that's experiencing this coveted level of attention and praise? These two are gesturing at you. This doesn't happen when we have a single guest. They're trying to eat. No one want, you don't want to answer this? It's got to feel wonderful, no?
I mean, it does feel wonderful. I don't think it's something that's on our mind. I mean, maybe I'm speaking for myself, but when we're at the restaurant, we're not thinking about, wow, we're really hot, we're really awesome, like, you know, living in that moment, we're doing our best to make sure that we're consistent and things are amazing and we're very focused on just doing what we do.
It doesn't change the work.
It doesn't change the work right. at all.
Yeah. David?
I mean, she took the words, I actually, you took the words out of my mouth, which were, you know, I try to talk about it with the staff, which is, you know, God bless Bon Appetit for donning this amazing gift on us and everybody else who said nice things about us. But as I've told everybody that works with us, it doesn't fucking matter. Like, the truth is, was I more proud of the work we were doing the day before everybody said it was great? No. I was just as proud that day. And to be honest with you, I still think we have the same things to work on the next day, mm-hmm. right? It to your point of there being so many restaurants opening all the time, you know, who cares? At the end of the day, it's like in 10 years, is anyone going to remember that we were the new hot restaurant? No, they'll remember if we're open or closed.
Right. And the truth and what their dinner was like last night.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's the thing. You know, that's what I really want to try and, you know, at least convey to our team, which is, you know, every day is what matters, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Bon Appetit has given us this amazing gift, and I think the gift comes in the way of revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the real gift. The gift is filling up the 10 o'clock seat, being able to do business in San Francisco, which is harder than anyone could ever imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And the gift is to be able to exist, right? Like, that's the gift that Bon Appetit, that's the gift that Washington Post and New York Times and San Francisco Chronicle, that's the gift they all give you, is everyone knowing that you exist, right? So at the end of the day, they're not making your restaurant great. You yeah. are every single day that you walk in.
You know, it's funny. Years ago, on the other end of a restaurant lifespan, right? Because almost every restaurant that isn't Chez Panisse or Spago has an end date, right? At some point. Like people. Like
usually
most restaurants are going to die.
Well, usually it's the end of their lease, if they're lucky. That,
right? That's one way it happens. But, you know, I was talking to Anita Lowe,
right?
Who had a Nisa restaurant in New York, and she said, you know, she went on Top Chef Masters, and that bought her a certain amount of time that she could keep going, you know? And then unexpectedly, late in the life of that restaurant, they got a 3-star review from the New York Times when they weren't even necessarily expecting they would ever be reviewed again. And then that bought them a certain amount of time, right? But it's also like that kind of at the beginning of a restaurant's life in terms of, right? In terms of giving you guys like kind of the wind in your sail to make a go of it.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely feels that way in the first year. It feels like every single time a publication comes out or something comes out that we're all, I think, maybe thinking, oh, okay, maybe that's another season of us being able to get the 10 o'clock seat filled, right? You know, hopefully what that, you know, ends up turning into is the fact that, you know, we're just a really great, everyday, amazing restaurant that withstands the test of time that people like to go eat at, right? Not for an experiment, not for the sheer, like, you know, curiosity,
yeah.
but more so because they've been there before and they know that they're going to get a delicious plate of food no matter when they come,
yeah.
and they can count on that.
Yeah. Just for the record, Angela's nodding affirmatively at everything David is saying.
That's so, usually that's the way our conversations
that's my
go.
Move.
Yeah. That's your move? Okay, and I also have to
or
say...
Or she'll not disapprove of
I have to just say, this, I feel like I used to feel when I used to work in film production. We're sitting in the back room at the... I'm sure I'll have said this in the intro, but we're in the back room of the Mermaid Inn. They don't open till dinner. The heat's not on. It's a little chilly. We all have our jackets on. I feel like I'm in a holding area on a film set. This is a very nostalgic feeling for me. But and Susan just brought us drinks. Thank
Susan's
you.
Thank best. You, Susan.
So if you hear crinkling and stuff, that's sweetener. Can I ask how old you guys are? Is that rude?
You can ask me.
How old are you guys?
I'm 41.
41.
36 tomorrow. No, 35 tomorrow.
Yay. Tomorrow? Wait, in New York City? Tomorrow.
Yeah, 35.
Where are you celebrating?
I'm celebrating by doing the event.
The party. Yeah. The Bon Appetit party.
The party
yeah.
for him.
This yeah. is like when Rafael Nadal has his birthday during the French Open.
Exactly, yeah. So, and then we're going to take, kind of a group of us are going to go to dinner at Carbone. eat some red sauce and drink some big wines.
Big group?
Yeah, like 10 people.
Perfect. Yeah. That's the, I always say that. If you want to go to that restaurant, bring a group.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So
do you feel like – the reason I asked that about the age is I feel like – and tell me if you disagree. But I feel like increasingly there's sort of I don't want to say stratification because it kind of judges people on one end of it. But people, I think, in your line of work are making different decisions about how much time they want to spend in the trenches paying their dues before they declare themselves ready to be a chef or a chef owner, right? You're smiling. I feel like the answer you gave me about the how you've taken this moment, right? This very sort of centered way of looking at it, right? This kind of eye on the prize way of looking at it is a very mature way of looking at it. It's the way I've heard people around your age and maybe a little bit older talking about when they got their Michelin star, you know, and that, okay, you know, we enjoyed 10 minutes. Now it's time to focus on tonight, right? I feel like, I mean, you both worked at 11 Madison. You put in the hard yards, as they say in sports, right? You did not go for the short, quick, finish line. I feel like your attitude toward this moment is a byproduct of that. Is that a fair statement? Do you feel like you have it's a function of maturity?
I suppose it's maybe what you're trying to get out of it for us. Or for me, it's more about the long haul. It's always been about the long haul, and it's not it's my passion, so I'm in it to win it for life,
mm-hmm.
right? So what a cheesy thing to say, but it's just what I do.
Yeah.
So it's not – I'm not just trying to make the bucks or get on TV or, you know, write a book mm-hmm. or be on Top Chef or all of those things actually – for me anyways, I have no interest in actually doing. I enjoy being in the restaurant and cooking.
Uh-huh.
So I suppose somebody that would be less mature might run away with these other avenues of it. But for me, it's a personality thing, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a byproduct also of working in great kitchens for great chefs.
Yeah.
Who have long careers and longevity in the business.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're kind of focused on.
Do you want to add anything to that?
Sure.
You don't need to.
I would love
but
to.
But I would love to know what that look you were giving me when I was asking the question meant.
Yeah, you know, to your point earlier, you know, you have to be careful because you're going to fall into this pitfall of being the get off my lawn guy, like, oh, 100%. I put in my time and you didn't put in your time. And, you know, and listen, there's truly vindicants out there who, you know, at 21 years old are geniuses, and and that's great for them. I wasn't one of them. But the fact of the matter is, there are not that many geniuses out there. And for most people who are opening restaurants right now, at a certain age, who haven't put in a great deal of time in this industry, you know, sure, they get swept up in this moment. And, you know, I feel like the way you handle it depends on how many times you've been kicked in your teeth in your life. And just because someone handed you an award doesn't mean that next day your restaurant's not going to shut down and you're going to lose everyone's money.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all these people who are counting on you to pay their bills mm-hmm. are not going to have that. And your friends and family who counted on you are, you know, going to feel disappointed and, you know, everything you worked on is going to go up in smoke, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, so, you know, like I said, the award is great, but give me revenue. Give me people coming to the restaurant. Like, I want to go to work every day. I want to go to the market every day. I want to buy produce. I want to see guests. I want to run my business. And, you know, I think, sure, that's a byproduct of maturity, but what is maturity besides, like, falling down as many times as you have throughout your life and recognizing that, hey, you know what? Like, you might be hot shit today, but tomorrow you're going to suck. Tomorrow you're going to have a terrible day. Tomorrow, like life will come back around and kick you right in the teeth again.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't, like, kind of get, like, a nice home base and, like, a little bit more settled and just do your work, you know, people are actually going to cheer for it at some point.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that's the difference between doing this when you're a little bit older and a little bit younger. When you're younger, you haven't experienced that really shitty fall from grace. And when you're older, you're like, you know what? Right around that corner is humility. And, you know, if I'm not putting in the work, I'm like, I got whatever's coming to me.
Have you had moments in your past that you feel like when you say this, getting kicked in the teeth?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I mean, a lot of people don't know this about me, but, I've been trying to open a restaurant since I left. So I left 11 Madison Park in 2012, yeah. And then I went to go travel Europe for a year. I went and worked with, like, Mauro Colagreco out there and Albert Adria and, like, a few different people because I had never had that moment in my life to go to Europe and stage. So I did that, and it was, like, this amazing experience. And I came back to California. I came to L.A. to, I wanted to do something, right? I wanted to open my own
– Your own place.
My own place. Mm-hmm. And to make a very long story short, you know, I – essentially took the first thing that was offered to me. I got written about in the LA Times. Vogue wrote about me.
Somebody was opening a restaurant and they needed a chef.
Exactly.
Okay.
You know, and, I kind of got a little bit of a bait and switch pulled on me in terms of, you know, hey, we're going to open this long-term restaurant with you, but we just need you to kind of, like, do this little project first type of thing. And, you know, it's like, what do you know? You know nothing. You know how to cook.
Right.
That's all you know. You don't know how to negotiate a lease. You don't know that your friend who's an attorney can't do your contracts for you because mm-hmm. they're not that type of attorney.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know that spending 10 grand on an attorney is actually a deal. You don't know that you can't solicit people to raise money because that could be securities fraud and you need to get, you need to go through a whole, you know, list of things to find, investors that are capable investors. You don't know any of that. And so, you know, I got into one of those situations and luckily it was short lived and it did not kind of get a lot of press around it. But it was one of those moments where, you know, the rug was pulled from under me when I realized that, you know, I was in a completely sour situation. And I had to start from zero again, wasting, you know, like a year and a half. After coming off of working at 11 Madison Park and then going to work at Mirazur and working with Albert Adria, like at that point, trust me, you think your shit doesn't stink at all. You think you're the you think you're the hottest fucking person around,
yeah.
Right? Like, and you're not. You are absolutely not. You're nothing at that point. You've done absolutely zero. You've worked like everybody else has worked. And if you want to do anything meaningful, you need to work every day and you need to put together millions of small moments mm-hmm. of hard work with no skipping. And you need to do the diligent thing. And anytime somebody offers you something that seems quick and that seems like, oh, this is really good. This will happen really quickly and I'll get everything I ever wanted. That's generally bullshit.
Right.
You know, because it's never real. It took us 4 years to open this restaurant.
It's amazing.
You know, and when people are like, oh, you're an overnight success, I'm like, sure, whatever. I've been in this business since I was 13, you know, and it took me 4 years to open this restaurant. You know, Angela and I walked through this space with our business partner, Matt, countless times as a auto body garage, sitting there banging our heads against the wall, wondering why construction doesn't move faster. You know, so it's like that old joke they say in the law business. They're like, you know, so somebody says, oh, it took you 10 minutes to write that contract. And he's like, the attorney is like, no, it took me 20 years and 10 minutes.
Thank you for all that.
Yeah, and it sucks. Trust me. You know, depression is a son of a bitch, especially, you know, when, you know, you get handed a piece of humble pie and you kind of sit there and you're like, wow, like, what does this mean for me?
Yeah. Like, also, I have to say, as much as I love the city, I think there are a few big cities where it would be harder to go through a time like that than Los Angeles. It's so big. It's so spread out. You can feel so alone there. You know, just ask any, you know, ask young actors who are trying to make it there versus actors who are living in New York where you're in an apartment building and you have, you know, like people around you versus, you know, looking out a window and just seeing like the landscape. It's different.
Yeah, Los Angeles is an interesting and amazing place. I try not to disparage Los Angeles because it gets, in our industry, it gets talked down a lot. I think Los Angeles has some things going for it as an amazing city. You know, it has the best ethnic food in the country,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
It has the best affordable food. in the country. And I think the diners in Los Angeles are some of the more sophisticated people. They just don't want to get dressed up to eat.
True.
Which I have no problem with because I don't give a shit what you're wearing.
Yeah. If, no, I happen to – I love L.A. But we're here to talk about
– Yeah. We digress.
We're going north. Okay. So let's talk about your guys' individual backstories if we could. You were originally from Ohio?
Originally from Ohio.
Yeah. What was what kind – what town? What was it like?
What was it like?
What was the name of the town?
The name is Alliance, Ohio.
Uh-huh.
Great name.
It's – I love the Alliance.
Name. I love that name.
It's a 30,000 people, kind of northeast Ohio, in between Cleveland and Pittsburgh.
Okay.
Very blue collar, small, small town mind set. Grew up in the country of that town, like on the suburbs. Kind of, pushed to go to college, like always, like set up. My father was like, "You're going to go to college." And I'm like, "That's great, right? I don't know what I'm going to study, but I'm going to go to college."
Had your parents gone to college?
My mother is a hairdresser who owns her own business.
Yeah.
My father started to go to college and then he had two children, so he stopped going to college. Now he has a master's degree in engineering.
Wow.
So we actually went to college at the same time.
How cool. Was that cool?
I mean, we didn't go together the same school necessarily.
You weren't like in the same.
We rolled in deep. Pinkerton. Yeah.
Right. Rodney, back to school. Wow.
That movie. Not too long ago.
Wow. With Keith Gordon. If you want to really go deep.
Triple Lindy.
So, wow. Is that right?
4.0. Yeah. I mean, he went back and made it. Wow. Made it happen.
Was it the same university? No.
Same university.
It was.
Different branches. So I went to Kent State University.
Okay.
For biology.
Wow.
What
did you think you were going to do with that?
I had no idea, to be honest.
But what drew you to that? I think a lot of people who end up doing something like what you do, what I do, you go to college and you end up doing something, you know, in the arts or English literature or biology tough stuff. I guess for me it would be. For you it was the equivalent of what English was for me.
My older sister is artistic, so she's always been doing art. So and I was the smarter or the, you know, got better grades sister or child. Mm-hmm. So I was I enjoyed science. And so I thought, well, I wanted to do archaeology. So I wanted to do archaeology, but, you know, my father was like, what is that? Where are you going to go get a job? You know, this is, like I said, kind of smallish town thinking, like you're going to move to Africa or something like that, as if that's what you need to do that. So then I was like, okay, so I'll do biology. Maybe I'll become a zoologist or work with animals somehow. I wasn't really interested in veterinary science.
Yeah.
But I didn't know. But I thought there's lots of jobs. You can take it a lot of avenues.
Yeah.
Biology. So I went to college for biology. Started working in a bakery as my first kind of job so I could move out of the dorms and get my own apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And then just...
Was that the first real sort of baking you had done?
That was my the real baking I had done.
Like, did you bake as a kid, or did you?
A little bit. We'd bake cookies, kind of, but...
Nothing out of the ordinary.
No. I wasn't, like, cooking in the kitchen, only because I had to, but it wasn't like I was passionate about cooking.
Mm-hmm.
We had a garden. My grandparents had an orchard, so I was always surrounded by that aspect of food.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like most families, it's like... You celebrate with food, like it's a thing in your life, but we never had a focus on it. Like it could become a career because where I come from, it's not, you cook to make a living. If you cook at all, it's not a place where you're like, at least when I was there, where there's like chefs and you go to their restaurants and you think of them in this elevated way that we think of now. In the career that I'm in now.
Yeah.
We didn't have that. That wasn't an option.
Right.
So when I was in college, I worked at a bakery, and I started doing cakes, and I found out I was good at it.
What does that mean for you when you say you were good at it? Like, did you, I've heard people who do a lot of pastry work mm-hmm. talk about like having good hands and mm-hmm. soft hands. Or did you just have? Did you seem that you had an innate sort of?
Yeah, I kind of it. I learned naturally. It was just like you were naturally good at it. You naturally understood what it took, mm-hmm. like to ice a cake, you know, the gentle pressure,
that kind of thing.
I was detailed, very detailed oriented about it. I think the first time I like could write on a cake legibly, I think that's kind of
the first time you tried it.
Yeah.
So you didn't have a lot of sort of failed science experiment looking things come out of the oven and right.
No.
Yeah.
I just understood. I was detailed.
Yeah.
Just I think the way my mind's built, it just works mm-hmm. for me in that aspect. So I ended up dropping out of college, which my parents were really thrilled about, and started kind of doing wedding cakes on the side.
On your own?
On my own.
Uh-huh.
Kind of started my little home cake business, and then decided actually got married in that time. And then that kind of fell apart and decided to kind of take a gander at pursuing the passion that I have developed over the years. So I moved to D.C., strangely enough, because I had a friend there. It was either D.C. or Chicago.
Because
To go to pastry school.
No, but I mean, why those two places? Well, D.C., you had a friend.
I had a friend in D.C., I think Chicago was not too far away from Ohio. Small town girl at the time. New York was scary. Like, I couldn't even imagine, like, being there. San Francisco's far away. So I looked at a couple programs, visited the French Pastry School of Chicago, decided to go to D.C.,
mm-hmm.
And then I went to a small school, Academy de Cuisine, in right outside of D.C., which is unfortunately now closed. Last year, they closed. But then I moved to D.C., went to school, actually got a job in cakes when I first moved there, something I was comfortable with, went to school, did my externship at the Ritz-Carlton,
mm-hmm.
Was there for 3 years.
What was that like?
It was interesting.
Can you be more specific?
It's great. I think the Ritz-Carlton is a great door opener. It looks really great on your resume. I think I actually suggest to cooks to actually work in a hotel because there's a lot of different avenues in the hotel that you can get a lot of practice in mm-hmm. with your skills.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a good skill builder. Working at a hotel is very interesting. There's a lot of things happening in there, a lot of drama within the walls of the hotel.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, beyond that, there's hotels, there's a lot of volume, there's a lot of special mm-hmm. events, there's a lot of things you might only do one time because somebody needs
good,
it for whatever.
It's a good experience. You get a lot. You can work in the restaurant and plate desserts. You can do production for large banquets.
Mm-hmm.
You do tea. We did a lot of tea service, which mm-hmm. is a lot like petit fours and Meyardis. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of chocolate work for holidays, mm-hmm. big displays. So I really recommend it for a lot of pastry cooks just to kind of get some practice.
Is it also good, you know, hotel, it's changing a little because some, you know, quote-unquote big-name chefs and groups have gone into hotels, mm-hmm. but is it also good because in some ways you don't have sort of the eye, in most cases you don't have sort of the eye of the media. It, you know, you don't have that, what we were talking about at the beginning of this interview, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're kind of spared that, right? I mean, you're kind of working in a...
I think so because you're working under the name of the hotel.
Yeah.
So the hotel gets all the attention.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't something I ever even thought about when I was working in the hotel.
Yeah,
I was
sure.
Just a cook.
Yeah.
Even when I decided to move to New York, it wasn't anything I had thought about. I wasn't pursuing, looking for some big name chef, to work for. I actually was looking for a mentor as a pastry chef mentor. And I had went to New York with friends to a culinary event at the FCI. They do those, like, three-day weekends mm-hmm. where they invite chefs to do demos. And there was a gentleman, Richard Bees. I don't know if anybody remembers him. I think he's in Spain now. But he did a demo. And I really loved his desserts. And when I was at the Ritz, I was looking for something. I was looking to leave to work in a restaurant because I hadn't worked in a restaurant. I had worked in a country club before, in the hotel, in a bakery. And I thought, I'll try restaurants. And I looked around D.C. But the jobs there, the pastry chef jobs, are like one person. It's pretty much you, and you do everything. And then they don't pay very well, nor do you have health benefits. Mm-hmm. That's what it was like 12 years ago anyways. So I was looking for something a little bit more like a real job.
Yeah.
Where I could take care of myself.
Yeah.
And I was like, fuck it. I'm just going to go to New York and see. Like, it's a four-hour drive.
Had you never been to New York before?
I had only been once for that weekend.
Oh, right. Sure.
But I didn't have friends. I didn't know anybody. And I was looking in Craigslist at the jobs. Uh-huh. And 11 Madison Park was looking for a pastry cook. And who happened to be the pastry chef? Richard Bees.
Oh,
so
my gosh.
It was actually him that brought me there, like his name, because I remembered him from the demo. And he was only there for maybe 6 months, actually. So I went and I staged with him. And I remember seeing Daniel walk through the kitchen.
This is Daniel Hume.
Daniel Hume.
Yep.
And he came up and he said hello, and I shook his hand, and I was like thinking to myself, well, he must be the chef because he's not wearing a hat, you know, like everybody else had toques on. and then I signed on to work with Richard at 11 Madison Park, which was hard because I took like a $4 an hour pay cut to move to New York City. It was very interesting, but I was like, fuck it, I don't care.
Right.
You know, I wanna find a mentor.
Right.
And then about a week before I moved, so I went back to the D.C. area, put in my notice, gave a three-week notice. My last day was like Easter Sunday, Easter brunch. But a week before I left, Daniel, Hume's assistant, called, and I spoke with Daniel, and he's like, well, Richard's not here anymore. But the pastry team had a lot of great things to say about you, and so we'd really like you to still come and work for us, but I just wanted you to know. And I'm like, well, I've already got an apartment and quit mm-hmm. my job, so right. I'll be there.
So you go to EMP.
I go to 11 Madison Park, and very, very different experience than anything I had done before. I think Daniel was there for less than a year when I started, him and Will. I started in April. I think they got 3 stars from the New York Times in December, or in September, I think, of that year. So it was very, you know, Daniel had, like, came and was kind of transitioning the space into something more refined.
Mm-hmm.
And the pastry chef that had been there, not Richard, but before Nicole was there, I think she had left, and some of her team was still there. And there was this strange dynamic. The pastry team, let's just say, was not real. They were not fans of Daniel Hume and him coming in and changing things, and the fact that the pastry chef left.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, I don't know, it was like, it was
there
hard.
There was some turmoil.
There was some turmoil. There was some turnover.
Mm-hmm.
He had a vision.
He had a vision, and, it, you know, it was very different from, I think, what a lot of the people signed up for.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of movement. So in the beginning, when I worked there, the first 6 months was kind of crazy. And I was just kind of learning. I started on PM service, and I was just learning how to do service and just kind of making through the day.
Mm-hmm.
So he hired a pastry chef, another pastry chef to kind of take over, and she left after 4 months in a flurry kind of. upset that she wasn't getting the attention she deserved. And at that time, I was running production in the morning, so kind of like leading the team. Mm-hmm. And Daniel asked me to work on a project. He wanted to start Minyard D's. He wanted to change the Minyard D's into something more refined. And so I worked on that with him. And then he asked me what my plans were, what my goals were. And I actually told him that I was thinking about leaving because I had moved there to work for a pastry chef. So that, you know, I was looking for a mentor. And it just seemed to be not happening, mm-hmm. Which kind of has been the path that I've been following for a while, to that point. And, he had said something about becoming a sous chef, and we kind of like left it on, let's talk again in 2 weeks. And then we got back together, we talked again in 2 weeks, and he's like, you know what, maybe I can't teach you everything about pastry, but I can teach you what it takes to be a chef. He's like, and I can mentor you in that direction. And so I thought, well, it's kind of a great opportunity. I mean, what else? What else is knocking at my door?
Yeah.
Let's give it a try. You know, he seemed very sincere about it. He's very passionate.
Mm-hmm.
The funny thing is, at that point, that was like a leap of faith, by the way.
At that point in the restaurant's...
You mean?
Well, in Daniel's career and that restaurant's mm-hmm. career, like, that was a leap of faith. You know, like, Angela had to kind of see something raw. I mean, I don't know.
We're talking about 11 Madison when it was still owned by Danny
mm-hmm.
Meyer.
Yeah, but even there was a part that was owned by Danny that was still very famous, right? Like, we're talking about, you know, post kind of, it was a brasserie when Daniel got there. They were doing cream spinach and steak frites, right?
Yeah.
And so, and Dan, you know, Daniel, whom, although got 4 stars in San Francisco, you know, was still relatively unknown. So all I'm saying is, you know, Angela had to see this thing that I think a lot of us saw, this like crazy kind of tinderbox situation going on there, to kind of look at it and be like, okay, I'm gonna see this through. Something's happening here, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I mean, at that point, you know, what other reason was there to stay, right? Like, you really kind of, as a cook, you want someone who can teach you techniques,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right. I mean, that's what I was looking for, is to become more technical at pastry. But I think I was, well, I know I was very lucky to start at 11 Madison Park at that time because, you know, I mean, Daniel's a famous chef now. He's there. Actually, for somebody who is as famous as he is, when I was there, he's around. Like, mm-hmm. he's always around. He's very much around. So, but I
still see him there when I come. If I pop in for a drink at the bar or something, yeah. if he's in town,
he's there. So I think that's very special. But he was there making the pasta. He was the only one making the pasta at the time. So I was there when he was in the kitchen cooking, and it's very special. Like, I had a very special relationship with him. I actually learned, I worked with him very closely. So I think what made me stay was the passion that I felt from him. You know, like, I hadn't found that. Mm-hmm. I hadn't found that anywhere else I had been. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is funny that that time, I remember going in, not that I did that often, but I remember when Daniel first came in, I very much remember being struck how things were changing in the dining room, you know, the serveware and, I mean, the food, first of all, his stuff. I mean, there were dishes that had so much work on them. It was apparent that he was, you know, it was also unlike anything Danny had done in terms of that level of, or that type of ambition. I guess that makes sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. He clearly wanted to take it in a direction, they ended up buying the joint. So, mm-hmm. yeah. David, let's get your story. Just because we just got to 11 Madison, do you think you could go backwards from 11 Madison?
Yeah,
would that be awkward?
I mean,
yeah.
No, I mean, not unless you make it awkward.
Let's change it up a little bit.
No, yeah.
Okay, so tell me how did you end up at 11 Madison and in what role?
So I guess I'll start just right before that, just a shred before that. I was a cook at at a restaurant called Crew, which was on Fifth and Broadway. And
this was Chez Galante.
Chez Galante. You know, Chez Galante was a boulet, you know, chef. Crew was ran in a very boulet type way. That wasn't a great fit for me. So I was like literally counting the days of my year being up, you know, of being like, this was probably a mistake, but you know, you give it a year, right? You always give it a year.
Well, this is one of the things that I would say, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but no, when I said before that I think cooks who operate on different ways today, that is an old school notion. The year. That's old school.
It definitely is.
Yeah. It's definitely usually associated with people older than you are. Yeah. But I do think people go into the kinds of kitchens we're talking about. That's what people do still expect. But it's not the industry norm anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's unfortunate. I won't
You're
not
Angela, right? You agree with that statement?
Yeah.
I think that is an old school sentiment.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I meant earlier.
Yeah,
like
totally.
When I say I think there's like these different clusters now of cooks and the way they look at the –
yeah,
how to go about it, and I'm not trying to be the guy, you know,
get off my lawn guy.
No, yeah. And I say it on the show all the time. Things change,
right? Totally, you know? And they change, and a lot of times they change for better and always they change for better and for worse.
Yeah.
And usually it's by the same mechanism that they are better and worse, right?
Yeah.
So,
I just had Joe Flam on the show recently from Spiaggia,
right?
And he was talking about a job, and he said, I was literally counting to 365.
Yeah.
You know, and I said what I just said to you. Like, that's – most guys your age aren't like that.
Yeah. Well, and I could rabbit hole down that for
anyway.
A while. But, you know, so basically I – and so the ironically enough, me and Chez Galante had the same two-week notice.
Oh, wow.
So Chez had come and given the cooks his two-week notice and let him know that he was going to go back to Boulay because, you know, like Crew kind of – you know, the recession was just hitting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Crew had slowed down. It was this kind of I mean, Angela will remember this because it was such like a key part of the ethos at 11 Madison Park. But there was this time where there was the 4-star restaurants, right, which were like, you know, Danielle, La Bernardin, Per Se,
John George. Yeah.
Right? And then Masa.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Frank Bruni had talked about these three restaurants that were, what was it? It was at the precipice of like the summit.
Summit.
Yeah. It was something.
Before
the 4-star dining, and he had said, you know,
oh, I remember
11
that
Madison
piece.
Park,
yeah. Cortone.
Cortone,
yeah.
And Crew.
Yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
Those were the three that were basically vying for what would be the next 4-star restaurant. And, you know, I remember at Crew, I went and staged at Cortone as they were opening.
Okay.
And, you know, I walked in there and I stopped for like 3 days straight and they had offered me a job as a chef tournant and I just remember thinking like, I'm not going to do this. I'm not doing this.
So I co-authored Paul's book.
Yeah.
So I'm going to leave you here with the microphone for a minute. And then
sure,
come back.
Sure. Listen.
No, go ahead. It's fine.
What
were you going to say? What did not work for you about that kitchen?
I mean, it wasn't the brutality, which I came up in this business, right? Like, I worked for Joël Robuchon,
yeah.
Right? Like the brutality didn't sway me.
Mm-hmm.
It was the – and now after, like, going back a while and working with more people that had worked for Marco and staging at places like, you know, Hospital Road and other things like that, you start to understand the level of theatrics that go on in kitchens like that.
Just
and
to explain.
Theatrics.
When David says Marco, Paul spent 2 years when he was still a teenager working for Marco Pierre White at what's referred to as the restaurant, the flagship 3-star Michelin, which is a demanding situation.
Sure.
Anyway, yeah.
Right. And, you know, and Gordon Ramsay had been there.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And so, you know, when you kind of go around and you spend more time with chefs that come from that lineage, you realize that, you know, a lot of the stuff that goes on is theatrics, right? It's a part of a show, right? Like I remember I was just recently having a discussion with a friend. No, sorry, not with a friend. With one of my cooks, who had left a job of, and I'm going to kind of leave names out of this part, but left a job for a chef who I know very well, who's like of my generation. He and I kind of came up through his whole career together, who had called him the "see you next Tuesday" word.
Okay.
And he had felt so demeaned by that word that he quit. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm like, that's so funny and ironic. And I was like, hey, listen, like, obviously times have changed. Like, you know, you really need to kind of keep up with the times and recognize that that's just not the way our industry is working anymore. Mm-hmm. It's certainly not the way our industry is working in San Francisco anymore. Mm-hmm. And just thinking to myself, you know, how funny is that? Because I know exactly where that lineage comes from. He was, you know, for he was one of the cooks at Cortone. And, you know, for those that go back to kind of like A Matter of Taste, he was actually one of the cooks, like, getting just absolutely reamed.
One of the ones who Paul says, I'm going to put your head through the wall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And yeah. So when you kind of go, when you really kind of go into that, you realize a lot of it is posterity, right? There's a lot of going on. There's a lot being said. But the truth is, you can survive in that kitchen just fine. If you just got to realize it's just words, right? I mean, yeah, you get hit sometimes and stuff like that, like in those kitchens, but you do in like old school French restaurants and things like that, right? So it doesn't, I'm talking about the theatrics in terms of the wordplay, mm-hmm. right? And I just remember being there thinking to myself, like, I don't want to subscribe to it. I'm not into it. It doesn't do anything for me in terms of, I think at that point I had already done enough in my career to not want, or to not actually feel like starstruck by that.
Yep.
Right. And I kind of saw, you know, although Paul at that point I thought was probably one of the most talented chefs in our industry, to me it didn't matter. I wasn't into
it. I mean, technically Paul is.
Technically Paul is probably the most
proficient. I don't
know if
there's anyone better than Paul. Maybe someone as good, but I don't know anyone who can do what he can do with food better.
Totally. You need more than that.
Right.
You need more than that. Yeah. And, you know, if, like, listen, we're going through a moment in our industry. We're going through a lot of really, really dramatic things in this industry, and there's a lot of really, really technically proficient people out there who are amazing. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, you know, you need to be a leader. You need to be a mentor. You need to be a businessman. You need to be able to get along with your partners.
Yeah.
You need to do a lot of things to get along in this business, and then you still might fail.
Right.
Right? So, you know, it's like, I try not to kind of like get starstruck by people who can do really, really pretty things on plates alone, because at the end of the day, it's like, that's not enough in this industry anymore.
No, I say this all the time. You know, there's no Emily Dickinsons in the cooking trade. I don't know if people know. Emily Dickinson was, you know, basically did all her poetry up in an attic in Amherst, Massachusetts, and, you know, her stuff got celebrated after she was gone. That doesn't happen with food.
Right. Well, yeah, food doesn't. Yeah.
You need a place to serve people.
Right.
Right? That's a fundamental thing, and to do that takes getting along with people, managing people, answering to people. Yes, I agree with that.
And by the way, I don't mean this in any way to be a throwing shade at someone who I, you know, as a chef, I think, you know, he's someone that I think has, when you talk about, you know, paying their dues and working their way up, you know, he's definitely one of the people who's one of the best chefs in the country. You know, I talk about this, I'm talking about it in the context of this industry and where it's going.
I totally get it.
Right?
So you,
So I left crew. So I went to stage at Cortone and just wasn't for me. And then I was planning on going to Europe at that point. So I, you know, basically I was making my plans. I was shooting my emails. I even had a couple stages set up. And, you know, months and months before that, I had met with a friend of mine who, you know, I'd worked at a previous restaurant with a few of his colleagues, that worked at 11 Madison Park.
Mm.
And we'll, Sweaty. We're Sweaty.
Sweaty, that's a name?
That's his nickname.
That's a name. I haven't heard that one before.
Yeah. You'll never guess why that was his name. So, yeah. The guy would go, like, through, like, 7 tokes a night. And so it was, you know, we all kind of met at the Swift for a few beers, and we're hanging out. And there was, like, a few guys from Veritas back then, and we're all kind of hanging out and having beers. And, you know, I meet this French guy, really, really nice guy named Fabian, and he's at that point the executive sous chef at 11 Madison Park, which, yep. you know, everybody in the industry, in New York at least, was murmuring about, but it was just like, it was still very raw. It was still very, very raw, right? Like, they were murmuring about it in this way of like, the food is very good. It's very different than anything else that's going on in the city right now. So fast forward a few months, I'm about to leave, and I get a phone call from Fabian saying, hey, I heard you don't work at Crew anymore. I was like, that's correct. He's like, do you want to come into EMP to stage for a sous chef position? And it was funny because I had heard they were looking for a sous chef, and I didn't bother applying because I thought that this was, you know, I don't know if New York's still the same way, but New York was this daunting place where you didn't deign to send your resume into a place that you didn't think that you were ready for that position, right? Like back in the
day. So there was a lot of self-screening.
At least for what I remember like thinking of people like, you know, you would talk about like, hey, I'm not going to go apply for a cook position at Danielle yet. I'm going to go work at a 2-star place and like learn how not to get my ass handed to me before I walk into that place, right?
I don't know the answer to that question. The only thing that might be different now is, as I like to say, it's so much now a cook's market, and there's such a desperate – you know, you see top restaurants now looking for job candidates on their Instagram accounts.
Yes.
All the time.
We do it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, people may take a little bit more of a chance, you know?
Sure. And, you know.
Like, what's going to happen when, you know, there's this Hudson Yards project here? Yeah. When like 35 restaurants are going to open like overnight, like someone flips a switch, where are these people going to come from?
Well, they don't exist right now, but that's
– It's crazy.
I mean, once again, that's kind of a rabbit hole to get down. You
yes,
know, but
exactly.
That's why, you know, that's why you see people opening restaurants at a younger and younger age, because those people are jumping to sous chef positions when they're like 23 and they've been in the industry for 2 years mm-hmm. and, you know – So at that point, it just wasn't that, right? Like, I, in my mind, had an insecurity about applying for a sous chef position mm-hmm. at that restaurant. You know, I don't think that's the attitude today. Mm-hmm. So in any case, he called me, and I said, you know, yeah, of course I've heard that. I just figured you guys probably had 100 applicants by now, and wasn't going to apply. And he said, well, we do actually have 100 applicants. But I was telling Chef that you worked at Robuchon for a number of years, and he's interested by that experience. So would you like to come and stage? And I was like, sure, what's the worst that can happen? Like, just to go check out the kitchen. But I was pretty set on going to Europe at that point.
Yeah.
Man, I walk in the kitchen. I remember I walked in the kitchen, and I was completely out of place. You know, I had a goatee at the time and had earrings. Yeah, I looked like, what was the band, the lead singer from, I had like a shaved
Angela,
head.
Do you remember his appearance at the restaurant?
Yeah, we were like, who is this guy? Yeah, he's got like diamond earrings in and facial hair. And like, now that I know you, like thinking back on it, I can like see, like you're all like, you know, like everybody's looking at you like this guy. I'm like, he's gonna lose the facial hair. Like, because we never, at least at that time, there had never been somebody that was hired in as a sous chef. You always kind of like, and that's like the mm-hmm, motto there, mm-hmm. but like, you always work your way up to it. Mm-hmm. So it was like outsider, you know?
Right.
Red alert
yeah.
kind of thing.
Yeah. And, it was totally like that, you know, so.
Could you feel that? Could you feel the eyes on you?
Not during the stage, but the first year, I felt like the target straight on my back.
Did you keep all that stuff in the first year?
Huh?
Did you keep the facial hair and the earrings?
No, I showed up to my first day of work with everything.
Yeah.
So basically, I came in for the stage,
yeah.
and, you know, it was unlike anything else. It was magical in that way that only a Danny Meyer restaurant and now a Will Gadara and Daniel Hulme restaurant can be, right? You mm-hmm. walk through the door and someone greets you. Hey, how are you? It's great to see you. Welcome. This is where you'll go. These are the people, you know, that you're going to be working with. People walk by you and they stop and they say, hey, how are you? I'm this person. I work at this station. Nice to meet you. Mm-hmm. Welcome. If you have any questions, let me know. Hey, it's staff meal. Please put your apron here. You know, we're going to go have staff meal together. okay, cool. Hey, this is service. This is what you're going to be doing during service. Hey, would you like to taste something? Like, it was done in this way that, like, you know, people who worked at Per Se or the French Laundry or at Alinea or at Danielle or at restaurants like that, you know, that's something that we've all come to know and respect as, like, what should be done.
Mm-hmm.
But anyone who's worked in other restaurants will know that that's it's not a normal thing,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
You oftentimes as a stage, you feel like you're there for a little bit of free labor to, you know, pick herbs for people or to chop yeah. their parsley, to do the shitty job that, like, a cook doesn't want to do that day. And more than likely, you're not going to get hired or you're not going to take the job. And, you know, people are dismissive of you because they don't really care that you're there.
Mm.
And that's the culture. And that really wasn't it at, you know, EMP. And so I just remember service starting and everything getting, like, you know, the heat lamps getting turned on and the pass getting wrapped with linen and, you know, the sauce pots going up. And listen, you know, perfection wasn't new to me at that point, right? Like, I had worked at Robuchon, but there was something different about, there was, like, this buzz, this feeling in the kitchen about what was going on around that. And the ticket machine runs in the first ticket, and Fabian pulls the ticket and says, order in, you know, two top tasting menu. And the entire kitchen of 35 cooks in unison yells, "Way!" And I get bumps down the back of my spine and my arms, and I say to myself, I'm going to work in this fucking place no matter what. I don't care if it's as a dishwasher, like, whatever it is, I'm going to get this job. So that night, you know, if Daniel likes you, you know, he asked the sous chefs to bring you something to cook. So, you know, they had given me, like, a snapper to break down and, like, cook, and I made a dish, and it was good enough to get me to do a tasting. So Daniel asked me to do a tasting. And I remember I was doing a tasting the same day as, like, somebody else, but, like, staggered by one day. I was doing my prep day the day they were doing their tasting, and it was funny. Like, I could actually look at the plate and guess where the dude had worked at before.
Yeah.
Right?
And I know exactly what you mean.
And I was like, interesting. Okay, I wonder how this is going to go. And the funny thing is, when I did my tasting, I was like, well, this guy doesn't want to see food that other restaurants have done, right? He wants to see food from here, right? That was my perspective. So I was looking at the food around me, and I was like, okay, so I'm going to do a tasting based on, like, what the food looks like here. And I tried to do that, and obviously, listen, if I were to taste that tasting today, I would rip it to shreds. But Daniel, at that point, was a real, I think, I still believe that Daniel's biggest trait as a chef is he is one of the best gauges of talent and harnessing of talent and guiding of talent mm-hmm. of anyone in this industry.
Mm.
Like, if you look back to that group of sous chefs that we had, you had me, Angela, Chris Flint, Jamal Kent, Abram Bissell, Tim Kaspari, Bryce Schumann, you know, Fabian, who's a chef in France now.
And Sweaty.
Yeah, Sweaty, who's a chef in Brussels now. I mean, and there's...
Have they translated his nickname?
There's Thomas Chen, who's the chef owner of Tome. There's, like...
Jamie at Sunday in Brooklyn.
Yeah, I mean...
Oh, Jamie Young. Yeah.
Maria. Jared from Maria.
Oh, Jared Gabau?
Yeah,
he's gone, but yeah. He went home.
Did Chris Jekyll?
Chris Jekyll,
who was the opening chef at iFiori.
Like, I mean, the list
goes
on, right?
Yeah, it's one of those moments in time.
Yeah, and so, you know, it's like, and so I'm sure that he was looking at my menu with all of the mistakes that were in it, but saw the potential in it,
mm-hmm.
right? And more so, he probably saw the way I was willing to give up anything that I thought about anything else and willing to just buy into anything he said.
Mm-hmm.
Which, at the end of the day, when you're looking for someone as a mentee, that's really what you want, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, he didn't expect me to be him. He didn't expect me to be he wanted me to be a loyal and faithful foot soldier, which is what you really do want. That's what everybody wants.
Yeah.
Because
you want Ethan Hawke in Training Day.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, totally, right? Like, here, have some PCP. Okay, sure, I'll try that. Why not?
When he looks at him and says, I will do whatever you say.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's really what you – and to this day, by the way, that's still what everybody wants, because you're going to teach everybody what you want them to know.
Yeah.
But you want them – to basically just be willing to drink the Kool-Aid.
My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
This program is brought to you by Jewel Sous Vide. My name is Katie Mosman Wadler. I am the executive director of HRN and a real-life Jewel user. When you cook with Jewel, there's zero guesswork, so steak, chicken, seafood, turkey, vegetables, and eggs all come out exactly the way you like them. The Paired app is intuitive to use and preloaded with all the recipes you'll need, and it has a great visual doneness guide. Jewel is awesome for holiday cooking. It's easy to cook for a crowd, and it's perfectly precise, so you can focus on entertaining without worrying about checking food temps, while Jewel does all the work. You can try out new cuts fearlessly. One of the best things I ever made sous vide was a juicy, tender heritage goose with juniper berries, and it was life-changing. And pro tip, Jewel is small and packs easily, so you can sneak it along on your holiday travels to be this season's food hero everywhere you go. With Jewel, you get perfect food every time. To get yours, visit chefsteps.com/Jewel and use code HRN, as in Heritage Radio Network, to get $15 off for a limited time. That's chefsteps.com/Joule, code HRN. And happy holidays from all of us at Team HRN. You're gonna get lucky.
Welcome back. We'll get you back to the rest of our interview with David Nayfeld and Angela Pinkerton in just a moment. Just our weekly reminder, if you'd like to subscribe to the show, you can do that on Stitcher and iTunes. You can also keep up with the show on Instagram, @ChefPodcast is the way to do that. The handle again is @ChefPodcast. And if you would like to leave a review or even just a rating at Apple's iTunes store, it really does help people find the show, and we really do appreciate it. I'm going to keep the mid-show break short this week and turn this right back over to what is, I know, a long interview, but bear in mind, you got two bios this week, so it's almost a twofer in a single episode. Returning you now to my interview with David Nayfeld and Angela Pinkerton, recorded at the Mermaid Inn in New York City a few weeks back. I hope you enjoy the rest of it. I think for cooks, right, there's a certain amount of time where you are just learning, right? And you take jobs because of what they're doing at the place where you took the job. And at some point, maybe when you're a sous chef and you start being able to do some specials or whatever, at some point you start developing your own style or having an outlet for your own style, right? Like, I always talk about chef's notebooks. You know, like the notebooks people keep. Like, if you look in the early notebooks or first half of them, however many they have, you know, you just see, like, salad dressings and notes, and it's all other people's stuff, right? Yeah. Stock or whatever. And then as you get further along, you start to see them starting to kind of sketch out their own ideas. You know, it's fascinating. I mean, you can really see the whole arc of a chef's evolution if you look from, like, cooking school or first job to, like, current.
Yeah, and that's something that I talk about. I just recently spoke about at one of our pre-meals with our cook team, which is the idea of not feeling discouraged by the fact that you don't know what your food is yet, because you're not meant to.
Right.
The truth is, I left EMP. I wanted to open my own restaurant. I didn't know what my cuisine was, which, in retrospect, I'm not sure whether it was right or wrong for me to leave at that point then. I knew that I was done at that point with the restaurant, and I knew that I wanted to work for myself.
Yeah.
I didn't know what my cuisine was, and naturally, after I left EMP, I think I spent a number of years doing food that was very derivative of EMP and the food we were doing there, right? It took me – and which was another silver lining of us taking 4 years to open a restaurant, because had 4 years to discover my own cuisine.
To morph.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think you'll find that with most chefs who leave very, you know, polarizing, amazing, yeah, top-level restaurants, is there is a level of derivative kind of through line through, like, you know, their former mentor and what they're doing. Yep. And it takes, I mean, and Daniel had it as well. Like, if you look back to Daniel's early career, it's very reminiscent of, you know, Le Pantabron and, okay, and Philippe Rochat and the, those restaurants, right?
It's the most, I think it's the most normal thing in the world. Totally. I think it's almost universal.
Well, I'm not a writer, but from what I hear that a lot of writers tend to, like, take a lot of inspiration from writers that they love, and yeah, they'll, like, slowly start to morph it into, like, a longer story that they, you know, like, stylistically, they'll start down, like, a path, like, you know, Hemingway or Dickinson or something, yeah, like that, and then they'll find their own voice, right? And then after a while, you kind of, you're like, this is actually the way I start a book.
It's very similar. Right. It's very similar, and it makes total sense. I mentioned this story when I had Angie Marr on the show, but I had a friend in college who wanted to be a poet, and he didn't read poetry because he didn't want to go through that stage. He just wanted to develop his own style, right? He didn't want to be imitating great poets he'd read.
Well, that's fascinating.
Which is interesting. I think that's more possible for a poet than for another kind of writer. I think you have to read. I think every time I read something great, my writing gets a little bit better, I think. Unless, once in a while, I'll read something so great that I can't write for a week. I can't read David Foster Wallace.
It's upsetting, right?
Because, like, then I go to write and I'm like, this sucks.
It's upsetting when you see somebody who's so naturally pure at what they do that it makes you look at what you do and you're like, yeah, my work is shit right now.
I'm sure there are chefs you guys must feel like this about. But, you know, my friend, the late Josh Ozersky, who was controversial, he was a good friend of mine. But Josh, once in a while, I'd read a sentence. You know, I'd read a sentence of his, and I'd go like, "I'll never write a sentence like that." I could sit down for a week. I won't write it. I don't know where that comes from. You know, but that's okay.
Yeah,
you know, room for craftspeople,
right?
Who get moment of inspiration, you know, here and there. We are. You guys have places to be. I don't want to shortchange your bio, so let's talk just for a couple of minutes. But I want to talk about your restaurants.
Sure.
Your restaurants. The current restaurants.
Sure.
So tell me how you got started.
So I was 13.
Yeah.
And I got into a lot of trouble. You know, and basically I was my parents are refugees. They came from Belarus, you know, during the Cold War, and came through Rome and waited for the refugee status in Rome and came to, you know, eventually got to the Bay Area. And you know, my parents both worked. My mom cleaned houses to get through chiropractic school, and then they were both entrepreneurs at one point, but they worked, right? So yeah, it's like, you know, there wasn't a lot of oversight. And so the way I grew up, and my brother was 6.5 years older than me, so that was like a big gap. We weren't like together as much. And so for me, it was like, you know, the time that, like, my brother got busted with a pack of cigarettes, like, you know, he got, like, you know, he was 6.5 years older, and they took the cigarettes and put it on top of the refrigerator, and then the next day I found the pack of cigarettes and went and smoked it, right? Like, so everything that was my brother was doing, like, 6.5 years before me, yeah, I would, like, see, and I'm like, yeah, I should be doing that too. So yeah, I was just in that phase, and, you know, I think at 13 years old, my parents were happy. When I showed interest in getting a job, you know, my parents were like, yeah, anything that will keep you off the streets and keep you not getting arrested. You know, at that point, I'd probably already, my parents probably were getting tired of getting called by the police to the,
wow,
you know.
So did you go dishwasher?
So first I was a produce stand, unpacker, like at an organic produce stand. And then like 3 months later, the Greek guy, Tony, from around the corner owned this place called Village Cafe, drove up looking for mushrooms and then told me, it's like a cliche, right? It's like, it says, hey, my dishwasher didn't show up.
Yeah.
I'll give you $35 cash if you come work tonight. And at that point, 13 years old, $35 cash is that's a fortune, right?
Yeah,
you don't
sure.
even know what to do with that. And so I called my mom and I was like, Mom, can I go like work? And she's like, yes, please do anything. Like just, yeah. And So I go around the corner, and it's the first time I walk into a professional kitchen, and it's loud. There was, like, these Vietnamese cooks in there, you know, young guys kind of, like, you know, making fun of each other and cursing and, like, flipping pans. And I walk over to the soap suds, and, like, I just – it was visceral. It felt so amazing, the hot water on your hands, the – basically – it was this moment of, like, me feeling like I had never fit in anywhere in my life before, and right now I fit in. Like, I could say anything I want, and nothing's inappropriate. I can do anything. All I have to do is work fast, and I fit in, right? Like, that's all I have to do, and that made sense to me. That rule book made complete sense to me. In school, the rule book didn't make sense because I would sit there, and, you know, with ADD, it's a real – it's, you know, schools is a real challenge when you don't know what's wrong with you, and you, everybody else is getting what's going on, and you stare at the wall all of a sudden for 30 minutes passes by, and you don't know why you stare at the wall, and you realize you missed the whole lesson, and there's a test on it.
Yeah.
And so you're like, school doesn't work for me. I don't understand. Maybe I'm stupid.
I think it's even worse than that, though, because I think so many people who end up in kitchens on the exact path that you just described, which we've talked about on the show a lot, and I've talked to hundreds of cooks about, I think very often the deal with you guys, and it's clear talking to you, right? These are people with a high IQ, but they feel stupid, right? You're smart, but you have this thing that makes you incompatible with a classroom situation. So you have this feeling of not being smart when innately you are smart, right? Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, so.
But you don't know that until you find, like, this job, even this career that you found and be mature.
Still even then, to be honest.
Really?
I think it's taken me, I think only in the past few years for me to accept the fact that I am actually a smart person. And it's happened a lot through my, kind of investigation and discovery about my ADD, and really actually, like, accepting that ADD is a thing and it affects my life, and it's not just like a, it's not just, you know how people are like, oh, I have OCD, so I wash my hands a lot. It's like, that's not fucking OCD. You don't know what you're talking about. And people that have OCD probably get really annoyed when you say something like that, right?
Right.
Like, you know, and, you know, people with ADD, whenever someone's like, oh, I have a tough time concentrating, I have ADD, it's like, go fuck yourself. You don't know what having ADD is, because if you think that's, like, the simple, like, you don't know why you get so irritated by something that you want to snap at people,
yes,
right?
Yes, a, like, lot of people are going by what they've seen in movies.
Right, of
right?
course.
They, and, I mean, yes. I'm not being flipped, by the way. I actually have OCD and take medicine. And
well, yeah, and the, I don't, yeah.
What people don't understand is there's the whole other, there's, those are the, these, those are the compulsions.
Right.
Most people don't understand what the obsessive piece is, but
right.
we don't have. We're not going to go into that today.
Well,
but yes, I think with ADD, it's the same thing. They don't understand that it can also, in addition to focus, lead to issues with what is called executive function.
Right.
You make bad decisions. You make decisions based on what you want this moment.
Yeah.
That if more someone else maybe would stop, consider it. What are the consequences? Da 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 da. Da make a different decision.
Right.
You literally, especially in childhood, are incapable of that kind of reflection.
Right. Well, and I mean,
so it leads to all these problems.
Well, and then also you go through your teen years with a lot of hormones and different things like that. And so in any case, you know, over the past few years, I've started to do a lot more reflection on that and recognizing that, to be honest with you, ADD is a trait if you learn how to, you know, where to kind of, you know, pun intended, I guess, focus it, right? So,
yeah.
You know, I can focus on something probably more than most people, and to a point that it's exaggerated. It just has to be compelling to me, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas for me to focus on something I have no desire to focus on, or it's not even a desire. It's like I'm not compelled to focus on.
Yeah.
It's painful for me to put focus towards.
But
like, and people trying to get me to go there, it's like pulling teeth for them.
But this is another very common thing in the chef world, right? It's very common that there are cooks who didn't do particularly well in school, right, do very well in the kitchen situation. And often there will be a very particular area of interest, not culinary, right? Like I have a friend who could tell you he's a cook, chef, could tell you everything about presidential history, U.S. presidential history. It's just something that fascinates. He could read that endlessly, you know,
right.
but not much else, you know?
Yeah.
or they're into music, or they're into whatever. I mean, some people are into, it could be anything, just whatever grabs them for whatever reason. Can I, I have to interrupt for one second.
Sure.
Angela, I just have to say, when David was just describing, like, I could go into a kitchen, I could say whatever I want, you had this amused look on your face, right? Because you're not that person. Like, that's not your profile.
The fact that I can go in and say whatever I want.
Is it?
That is my profile.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, you've had to, like, I just pull you back on that.
Really? Okay. I thought what I thought I was reading, yeah. Well, also you had gone to college and started down the biology road.
No,
so.
But you should see photos of her. Like, I mean, pink hair, like, like the mohawks that you, she was a badass.
Yeah, I still am.
Okay.
Touché.
Before we lose sight of it, tell me about the first of your current restaurants and how it came about.
Que Fico.
Que Fico. I was afraid to try to pronounce it.
Don't worry about it. Que Fico. Que Fico and Theorita.
I want to put a little mustard on it though when I say it.
You should, because you're supposed to say it with gusto.
Is that right?
Because oftentimes you say it with a yeah, exactly. It's meant to say, oh, that's awesome. So it's Que Fico.
Yeah.
How'd it come about? Okay, so, Los Angeles happened. I kind of, was in this moment of, feeling a little bit down. But I recognized at that point, if I'm going to do anything, I need to be the one doing it 100%.
Mm-hmm.
I need to learn how to raise money myself. I need to learn how to negotiate a lease myself, how to do financial projections. I need to learn all that stuff.
Yeah.
So, basically it was a bunch of, 4 a.m. Google sessions and reading books and figuring all that stuff out. And
yeah.
I started looking at restaurants in Los Angeles and recognizing that I wasn't finding what I wanted and getting a little bit of a longing to be back in the Bay Area where I'd grown up. That's
mm-hmm.
kind of where I wanted to be honest. And I had no idea how I was going to raise any money at all. And I was just like, okay, whatever. Let's go to San Francisco and see. And I looked at 30, 40 spaces.
Yeah.
And every time I would, and always probably with like 4 or 5 different real estate agents. And it was always, the same experience. The real estate agent would try and pry out from me whether I had raised money or not. And I'm not, I'm not a very good liar. And usually it would be like, no, I haven't. And then it would just be like, I'm not going to waste my
time.
You're
not a good liar?
lying?
I would think you would be really good.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, lying's not...
From the childhood you described, I would think it would be a survival skill.
Yeah, well, I mean, lying to cops, that's one thing. Like when you're like 15 years old and like, the thing is...
I'm sorry, I guess that was an insulting question.
No, it's not. It's actually... it's not. I guess the truth is, the funny thing... is I've never really been much of a liar because I didn't grow up in a house where you needed to lie,
right?
Like my parents were always like, listen, if you're going to do drugs, like be fucking honest about it, all right? If you're going to come home high, like don't be a liar. If you're going to smell like cigarettes, don't tell me you don't smell like cigarettes. Don't treat me like I'm a schmuck, right? And so I didn't grow up in a house where you had to lie a lot. And so I just learned that, say the truth and deal with what the fallout is.
Yeah.
And I'm more of a kind of like, what are you going to do about it type of person anyways,
mm-hmm.
And so I don't really tell lies.
Got it. You wanted to be back north.
Got it.
You looked at a lot of spaces. They were trying to pry whether or not you had financing.
Yeah, and it would always be the same thing, which is like, yeah, sorry, I don't want to spend more than like 1 or 2 times like showing you places because, it's going to be a waste of time. I've seen this all before, right? So I knew I needed to find a real estate agent who would – at least see some value in me, and I was coming to the end of my rope, and I had cooked for Dominique Crenn in Los Angeles for her birthday,
mm-hmm.
and she had reached out to me and said that was like one of the best meals I've had in a long time, thank you so much, and if you ever need anything, let me know. If you want to come and do like a collaboration dinner at Atelier Crenn, I'd be happy to have you.
That was nice.
Yeah, she's one of the sweetest people on the planet. I love her. And so I reached out to her. I said, hey, do you have a real estate agent? And so she put me in touch with hers, but basically did the kind of magic touch, which was like, hey, pay attention to this guy. He's going to do something important. And the real estate agent
was took.
Well, and he on his own was like one of those people. He was from New York. He was just a little bit more kind of like down to earth. He wasn't this like he wasn't like one of the new real estate people, mm-hmm. right? He had been in the game mm-hmm. for a long time. So he met me and he's like, okay, listen, I've done a lot of research on you. I know who you are. I know what you're trying to do. Why don't you tell me about your project? So I brought like my whole deck with me, the whole thing. And I pitched him the way I was going to pitch an investor. And he was like, okay, I get it. I totally see what you're doing. He's like, what we need to do is we need to find a landlord that's going to see what you're doing too. So I'm going to show you some spots, but let's keep in mind that it's like the landlord here is going to be key. And so we looked at a few different spots and, you know, some of them were interesting, some of them were not. And then all of a sudden we pull up to this massive auto body garage and this massive man is standing outside of it, which is the landlord, this yeah. huge guy. And I walk over to him and my real estate agent introduces me to him and we like hit it off right away. He's like the sweetest, kind of very soft-spoken giant.
Yeah.
And we walked through the auto body shop, and I remember walking to the top floor and seeing the vaulted ceilings and the skylights and the cement. And
you had a vision.
I knew I had the goosebumps go up my like spine the same way as I did the second mm-hmm. that they called in that first ticket at EMP, and I knew at that moment that I needed to open a restaurant there.
Yeah. And where did the Italian focus come from?
No, I've always so working at Crew.
Yeah,
I developed a really big interest in the pasta program there. You yeah. know, they had one of the most exceptional pasta programs mm-hmm. in the city. And Shea did some of the most delicious, beautiful food in general, but pastas were something that I really fell in love with when I was there. And, you know, I knew I wanted to do more with that, and it just lent itself more to what I naturally enjoyed cooking. And then I just started traveling. You know, anytime I would get a chance to get, you know, have any time, I would start traveling to Italy and, like, going through those areas and sitting there and eating meal after meal in trattoria after trattoria and going to different parts of the country and just experiencing these things and recognizing that I'm like, wow, I've been in French 3-Michelin-star restaurants my whole career, but really at the end of the day, I don't hear that calling to me. I hear mm-hmm. Italian food calling to me. I hear a bowl of pasta, a simple plate of chicories, fried artichokes, those things, you know, salumerias, like cheese, just the nuance of beautiful product mm-hmm. placed together mm-hmm. without the chef. Mm-hmm. The chef essentially being this kind of like...
This conduit
of yeah. ingredients, right? Yeah. Like, yeah. You introduce these things together. Mm-hmm. You did not manipulate them. You mm-hmm. did not do this whole radical kind of production of things. You really did. Listen, there is a level of alchemy. And alchemy, I think, is one of the most important things in cooking that I think people, time and alchemy are two of the more important ingredients in cooking, right? Mm-hmm. But getting amazing ingredients, putting them together and not fucking them up is also, I think, hugely important in what I consider our cuisine, mm-hmm. right? I don't do much to it.
Got it. Angela, when you come into – first of all, did you two talk about back when you were in New York together, doing something together? How did you come into this? And where, again, this focus of that restaurant – how did it jibe with your sensibility, your background?
I don't think we ever talked about doing a project together when we were in New York. Because you left like 3 years, I think, before I did. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, three.
You left 2015?
I left in the end of 2014.
So 2 years?
2 years. And I really had no idea that I would move out west, so it wasn't a plan.
Yeah.
We ended up being out there at the same time. And we're friends, so mm-hmm. when I moved to the Bay, David would come and visit his family and we would have coffee and mm-hmm. have drinks and hang out and
she would come to Thanksgiving.
I would go to Thanksgiving and you know, his mother's a saint and amazing. She's my other mother.
Uh-huh. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, that's great. Galina.
That's great.
She's kind of the
beautiful,
mom.
Yeah. a beautiful woman.
She has a lot of adopted, unofficially adopted adults.
Yeah, she's also a chiropractor in San Francisco for
the past
30
years. Yeah. That's a good person to have in your life as a cook.
Yeah, and she's, you know, self-made woman and kind of amazing. And so anytime somebody's back hurts, they go see her from the restaurant. It's pretty awesome.
What's her name?
Galena.
Okay. I saw a chiropractor in San Francisco this year. I wanted to make sure that wasn't she. Okay, but go ahead. So how did – what about the whole focus of the program there and how – this is always an interesting thing to me, like how desserts fit in. You know, it's the last thing you eat in a meal. There is a pastry chef often. You have your own style and sensibility, but it does need to seem of a piece with the overall experience of the restaurant, right?
I think it's – I mean – because it took 3 years to get going, we we had a lot of time to kind of work on that style together by doing private events and investor dinners, and you know, we were not being paid through the restaurants in any sense of the word. We had to make our own money, so we did a lot of events together. So we had time to kind of build. What we wanted, and really Keifiko is David's brainchild, really. So it's, you know, while I'm creating the pastries, I'm also working with him to kind of speak his voice in the pastry department as well. So we had a lot of time to work at that together throughout the years. But I think, because we come from the same background, we also have the same feelings when it comes to finding amazing produce and really letting that shine and not muddying that up with techniques that are just to be technical. And I think California and San Francisco especially is a you know, a great place some of the most beautiful products in the world, not just in the United States, come from there, and so we find a lot of Keifiko identity, I think, is from where we are in the world and from the products themselves.
Do you feel like, and I guess I'll make this the last question, but it is interesting to me. I feel like I come across more and more people who have worked like at the 3-star Michelin level, right? I mean, here in New York, right, there's the couple that have Uncle Boone's, right, who both came out of Per Se. More and more I feel like I find people who have that background, but when it comes time to do their own thing, aren't necessarily trying to do that. They end up going in a direction not unlike the way you two have gone. Do you perceive that out there? Do you feel like that's something that's either generational or that's sort of something that's just happening at this moment? Do you feel that's just a reflection of how more and more people like to eat and cooks are, you know, part of that population?
It's definitely the path that I've taken, that I think we're taking. I think we definitely have a love for fine dining.
Sure.
For me, especially with leaving 11 Madison Park and with our second restaurant, Theorita, I don't want to be part of, how do I put this? I want to be part of people's everyday, not just their special occasion. While, yes, I would love to be part of their special occasion as well.
Sure.
I want to be in touch with the people that are coming in. And I want to be part of their daily lives. Like, I think both Theorita and Keifiko are very neighborhood. You know, you can have a lot of different experiences at Keifiko. It's a very neighborhood-centric restaurant. And I think that's part of the change for some people. When they leave fine dining, you get kind of tired of, like, not just cooking regular food, I guess. For me, anyways, that's what it was. And I just wanted to be back in that casual setting where you're making people's everyday lives or everyday meals special.
I guess I always not always, probably recently, started asking what's the point of certain things, right? Mm-hmm. And to me, to do a fine dining restaurant, I think you should have an idea that is so singular that it's 11 Madison Park or it's Noma, it's, you know, the French Laundry, it's Alenia, right? Like, it's one of those types of restaurants. I see so many fine dining restaurants that I look at as completely derivative or in some way meaningless, right? It's just...
It's ambition without a vision.
Yeah, or yeah, without or a the
personal,
story. Or
without a personal spine, yeah.
Yeah, and the truth is, like, I don't care for that. I don't care to do that. You know, sure, I could... If I wanted to, I could do something like that. But yeah. If I ever do fine dining, I want to wake up one day with this itch that I need to scratch, with this space that needs what I want it to be. And then I'm going to fight ferociously to realize that, right? But the truth is, like, you know, I ask what's the point with everything, right? Like, not every city or even not every neighborhood needs a fine dining restaurant, but yeah. Every neighborhood needs a great bakery. Every neighborhood needs a great Italian restaurant. Every neighborhood needs a great Chinese restaurant.
Yeah.
And if you can provide that, then that's the point, right? And, you know, I think about also stylistically with the food, right? Like, what's the point of the way you're trimming something, the way you're cleaning something, right? Are you doing it so it appears to be perfect on a plate? Or are you trimming away parts that are otherwise beautiful and perfect and amazing? And the only reason to trim them was to appear to be perfect, right? And so stylistically, it just didn't jive with what I wanted my cuisine to speak to.
I could talk to you too for another hour, but you have a lunch to go to. People don't know. We actually stopped the recording at one point. I went out and refilled the meter. Susan called the restaurant to say you guys were going to be late for your lunch. Maybe you're about to do that again. You'll get there. We're not too far away. Anyway, great meeting you both.
It was really nice to meet you too.
Big congratulations on everything, not just the Bon Appetit thing. And I know where I'm coming for dinner next time I come to San Francisco.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Breakfast and dinner.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Theorita is open for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So we're actually pretty stoked about that. That's like what most of us are spending our every day on right now. Mm-hmm. So we're pretty excited.
Awesome. Cool. Thank you.
See you there.
And that's our show for today. Caitlin, thanks for jumping in at the last minute. I know people were happy to hear from you.
You're crazy.
No, they are. You know, I got a comment on, or not a, a review on iTunes recently that said, I don't know what it is, but I like your intros better when your wife's there. Maybe it's just your energy.
They did not say
that. I'm
going
to show it to you.
I actually don't believe you.
100% true. Anyway, thanks for jumping in. I needed you. I don't do well with last minute stuff.
It's my pleasure.
The re-record threw me for a loop. I needed moral support.
It's okay. Netflix is there 24/7.
That's true. And it's still not enough hours. David Nayfeld and Angela Pinkerton, thank you very much for your time. Thanks for your patience waiting for me to get the show up on the air. Again, my sympathies on Theorita, but my great congratulations on the continued success of Que Fico. Vitor, thanks for the last minute edit today, Saturday. I really appreciate it. Matt, Katie, and Kat at Heritage, thanks for helping me get these extra shows up during the season as well. To all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening. And a reminder, Andrew Talks to Chef live at the Bell House in Brooklyn, New York, January 12th, 2019, 2 p.m. Hope to see you there. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you back next week.